OA1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., John Russell, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Huge fields of ice, high in the mountains near Tibet, continue to disappear at a rate that worries scientists. The melting glacier is the largest in the Chilean Mountains, which stretch for 800 kilometers on the dry northeastern edge of the Tibetan Plateau. The glacier has retreated about 450 meters since the 1950s, when researchers set up China's first observation station to study it. The 20-square-kilometer glacier is known as Laohugo Number 12. Scientists say it has shrunk by about 7% since measurements began. The rate of melting has increased in recent years, scientists note. The ice also has lost thickness. About 13 meters of ice has disappeared as temperatures have risen, said Qin Xiang. He is the director at the observation station. The speed that this glacier has been shrinking is really shocking, Qin told Reuters news agency. The scientists work in the station in a frozen, treeless area, where Qin and a small team of researchers measure the changes over time. The Tibetan Plateau is known as the world's third pole because of the amount of ice that is locked in its high-altitude wilderness. But since the 1950s, average temperatures in the area have risen by about 1.5 degrees Celsius, Qin said. He added that there is no sign of an end to the warming. He is concerned for the 2,684 glaciers in the Chilean Mountains. China's Academy of Sciences says that across the mountains, glacier retreat was 50% faster from 1990 to 2010 than it was from 1956 to 1990. When I first came here in 2005, the glacier was around that point there where the river bends, Qin said, pointing to the Laohugo Valley, where the river runs. Downstream, near the city of Dunhuang, water flowing out of the mountains has formed a lake in the desert for the first time in 300 years, state media reported. Rising worldwide temperatures are also blamed for changes in the weather that have brought other unpredictable conditions. Snowfall and rain have at times been much less than normal. The melting glaciers have brought more runoff. But farmers downstream can still face water shortages for their crops of onions and corn and for their animals. Large parts of the Shula River outside of Dunhuang were either dry or reduced to small sections of water Reuters reported in September. Leo Junyan is a Greenpeace East Asia climate and energy campaigner. Leo said, "The melting water brings danger." Across the region, glacial meltwater is pooling into lakes and causing floods, Leo said. The melting on the mountains could peak within 10 years. After that, China Academy of Sciences expert Shen Yongping said, snowmelt would sharply decrease because there would be fewer glaciers. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
Mary Nafula learned she had cancer a year ago. She survived the cancer treatment, but her hair fell out. The hair loss made the mother of three feel unprotected and weak. Nafula found help at a beauty salon in Nairobi. Women go to salons for haircuts and beauty treatments. But this business in Kenya's capital offers other products. It gave Nafula a wig to cover her head. The wig replaces the natural hair she lost during the treatment. Nafula describes her new feelings of confidence in herself. "We can embrace all the challenges that accompany us, knowing that we are going to heal," she says. The World Health Organization says cancer is the third leading cause of death in Kenya. Cancer deaths are rising from 37,000 reported cases in 2012 to almost 48,000 currently. Dr. Gladwell Kiari is a cancer specialist at the Nairobi Hospital. She says the rise in cancer deaths is probably a result of lifestyle changes and more testing for cancer. "We are smoking more. We are taking alcohol more," Kiari said. "Our traditional diets have changed, and we no longer eat the traditional food that we used to. We have more fatty foods. We have less water and greens in our foods, more processed food." Kenya's government has launched information campaigns and opened more testing centers across the country. But most Kenyans do not have enough money for treatment. Nafula said she was lucky enough to be able to pay for her cancer treatment. She says she is happy to have a wig and to be free from criticism on the streets and in the public transport vehicles, called matatus. Nafula described being very sick and trying to ride in a matatu. She was told, "You should not enter the matatu because cancer can infect us." Nafula added, "I felt so bad." Diana Akech is the owner of the beauty salon where Nafula got her wig. Akech started doing beauty makeovers 5 years ago after a friend got cancer. The friend lost her hair, but Akech gave her a wig. Akech said she put the story on social media and started hearing from many people. "Let me say my friend gave me the willpower to keep doing this. She's in heaven right now, and I am sure she's very proud of what I'm doing." The wigs cost around $250 each and are paid for by hospitals and businesses. Recovering from cancer can be long and painful. A wig can reduce the pain and show patients that they are not alone. I'm John Russell.
Most of the efforts aimed at reducing climate change center on reducing the use of fossil fuels. But a new study warns that pollution caused by the world's food production system is also a major driver of rising temperatures on the planet. The study found that if the world food system stays on its current growth path, it will produce nearly 1.4 trillion metric tons of greenhouse gases over the next 80 years. That pollution is expected to come from fertilizers used in agriculture, mismanaged soil, food waste, and methane gas released from cows and other animals. Other causes include land clearing operations and deforestation. Researchers from the University of Minnesota and the University of Oxford in Britain led the study, which recently appeared in the publication Science. The researchers predict that even if fossil fuel emissions were halted now, emissions from the world food system would make it impossible to reach current international climate change targets. They say that emissions from food production alone could push world temperatures past 1.5 degrees Celsius by the middle of this century, and above 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. A main goal of the 2015 United Nations Paris Agreement on climate change is to keep rises in the Earth's temperature during this century to between 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius. The UN has said that in order to stay below the 1.5 Celsius level, emissions must fall at least 7.6% each year through 2030. The new study calls for immediate improvements in farming practices as well as changes in what we eat and how much food we waste to help reach the Paris Agreement goals. Jason Hill is a professor of biosystems engineering at the University of Minnesota. He helped lead the study. He said in a statement that the research clearly demonstrates that food has a much greater effect on climate change than is widely known. Hill also noted that fixing the problem would not require the world's population to completely stop eating meat. The whole world doesn't have to give up meat for us to meet our climate goals, he told the Associated Press. We can eat better, healthier foods. We can improve how we grow foods. And we can waste less food. The researchers say such efforts are achievable and can also lead to many other improvements beyond controlling climate change. These include making humans healthier, reducing water pollution, improving air quality, preventing animal extinctions, and improving farm profitability. The study makes the following predictions. A nearly complete change to a plant-rich diet around the world could cut nearly 650 billion metric tons of greenhouse gases. If almost everyone ate the right number of calories based on age, around 2,100 calories a day for many adults, it would reduce emissions by about 410 billion metric tons. If farming could reduce carbon levels by using less fertilizer, managing soil better, and doing better crop rotation, it would cut greenhouse gases by nearly 540 billion metric tons. And if people wasted less food at home, in restaurants, or by getting it to people in poorer countries, emissions could be cut by about 360 billion metric tons. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. 2 years of a bitter, bloody civil war started to show their effects on both the Confederate States of the South and the Union States of the North. Both sides began to feel the pressure of the costly struggle. The South, however, felt the pressure more severely because it was weaker in troop strength and industrial strength. Morris Joyce and Jack Moyles discuss the early summer of 1863 in the American Civil War.
In 1863, the Confederate States were becoming short of supplies. Food and guns were difficult to find to keep the Confederate armies in the field. Men were also needed, more and more men. There seemed to be no end to the demand for men to fill the places left empty by dead and wounded soldiers. Many in the South were heavy of heart, and hope among them slowly started to sink. The war was tiring. Its suffering was more than they could bear. And the situation in the West made matters worse. Union armies were on the move in the states of Mississippi and Tennessee. Their successes were becoming a serious threat. They might soon win control of the whole Mississippi River. This would split the states of the Confederacy and might end its very existence. Something was needed to raise up the spirits of the South, to break the pressure of Union armies.
General Robert E. Lee believed that he had the answer, an invasion of the North. This, he felt, would throw fear into the people of the North and weaken the Union war effort. Lee had organized an army of 75,000 men at Fredericksburg, Virginia, halfway between Washington and Richmond. Lee began moving his men June 3rd. They marched northwest into the Shenandoah Valley. The valley led north to the Potomac River. Across the river was the narrow neck of western Maryland, then Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was the target. Its rich farmland produced plenty of food, enough to feed Lee's hungry army for the summer.
S-
Standing in the way of Lee's army was a small Union force at Winchester in Northern Virginia. There were only 7,000 Union soldiers, and they had no idea that the Confederate army was nearby. The Confederates easily defeated them. More than half of the Union troops were captured. The others fled. Now, there was nothing to stop Lee from marching into Pennsylvania. The huge Army of the Potomac was behind him, near Washington. The Union commander, General Hooker, had to keep the army between Lee and Washington to prevent the Confederates from seizing the national capital. Lee's army crossed western Maryland and entered Pennsylvania. His soldiers found the Pennsylvania countryside very different from Virginia's. Virginia had been a battleground for 2 years, and the land showed it. Many of its farms had been destroyed. Its stores were empty. Pennsylvania had not been touched by the war. Its big farms were rich. Its towns and villages were full of food and goods of all kinds. The hungry, poorly clothed soldiers could not believe their eyes. This was the land of the enemy, they cried, and they could take whatever they wished. But General Lee said no. He said supplies could be taken only by Confederate supply officers. And, he said, they must pay in Confederate money for everything they took.
Lee did not want to anger these people in Pennsylvania. Many of them did not support the Union war effort. Some of the rich farmers said openly that they did not care who won the war. They said they only wanted to be left alone. Lee was sure that many in the North felt the same way. There had been signs that people were growing tired of the war. Coal miners in eastern Pennsylvania had shown their feelings toward the war a few months earlier. They rose up against a new law drafting men into the Union Army. The miners did not want to fight. They refused to join the army. They rioted and attacked officials who tried to take them. Soldiers were sent to the mining areas to put down the riots.
Farmers in nearby Ohio also rebelled against the draft law. They refused to be drafted. Instead, they took guns and battled soldiers who came to arrest them. Feelings against the war were growing stronger, not only in Pennsylvania and Ohio, but also in several other farm states of the North. These areas saw a growing support for a peace party, a political party opposed to the war. Leaders of this movement were Democrats called Copperheads. They got this name because they wore on their coats a copper penny with the head of an Indian.
The chief Copperhead was a former Ohio congressman. His name was Clement Vallandigham. As a member of Congress, Vallandigham criticized the war and the Republicans. He told them, "The war for the Union is, in your hands, a most bloody and costly failure. War for the Union was abandoned, and war for the Negro was openly begun with stronger effort than before.
With what success? Vallandigham asked. Let the dead at Fredericksburg and Vicksburg answer. Vallandigham said he wanted peace, and he wanted it immediately. He offered a simple program. Stop the fighting. Make a ceasefire. And let some friendly foreign nation negotiate peace between North and South. After he lost his seat in Congress, Vallandigham opened a campaign to become governor of Ohio. He traveled all across the state, speaking out against the war. He said Republicans did not want peace. He said they wanted to fight until every black man was free. The Union military commander for Ohio was General Ambrose Burnside, a former commander of the Army of the Potomac. After losing the Battle of Fredericksburg, Lincoln removed Burnside as Army commander and sent him to Ohio. Burnside was worried. Too many people in Ohio opposed the war. He believed that much of what was being said and done in Ohio was close to the crime of treason. Burnside announced several new measures to quiet the opponents of the war. One of these orders limited the right of citizens to criticize government military policy. Another declared that statements of support for the enemy would be punished as treason. Vallandigham refused to recognize Burnside's right to give such orders to civilians. On May 1st, he made a campaign speech to a big crowd at Mount Vernon, Ohio. He denounced Burnside's orders and spoke of the president as King Lincoln. Vallandigham claimed that Lincoln was using the war to become a dictator. He said Lincoln did not want peace, that the president had rejected peace offers from the South. Once again, he said the war was not a struggle for the Union, but a fight to free the slaves of the South. And he said, men of Ohio, who let themselves be drafted into the Union Army, were no better than slaves themselves.
Burnside had sent several Army officers to listen to the speech. When they reported what Vallandigham said, Burnside ordered his arrest. Without question, the man had violated the general's orders. Late the next night, soldiers went to Vallandigham's home in Dayton. They knocked on the door and said they had come to arrest him. Vallandigham called for help and refused to let the soldiers enter. They broke down the door, seized him, and took him to a military prison in Cincinnati. A few days later, Vallandigham went on trial before a military court in Cincinnati. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.